You are listening to Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm glad to have your company on this Sunday afternoon. You'll want to stay tuned because The Spark is back, and we'll have that for you later on. Plus, this week's Our Island Universe, as well as a sound-rich story about the sound artist-in-residence, Diane Ballin, at Shenandoah National Park. Jordy Yeager tagged along with her recently to Dark Hollow Falls. So if you haven't been to Skyline Drive lately, stay tuned for waterfalls and squirrels and birds and how all that stuff is recorded. But first, most of us learn about the global refugee crisis through news coverage rather than through personal experience. WMRA has been telling the stories of many refugees who have settled in Virginia, but what is the refugee experience in quieter parts of the world, far from the global media's attention? WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini takes us to her rural hometown in the east of France, a little place called Saint-Loup.
Meet Hébage Boré.
I'm 37, married. I have two children, a boy and a girl. I've been in France for 2.5 years.
And here is Arieta Yoni.
I'm an Albanian language and literature teacher. I'm 33 years old and arrived in France on September 8th, 2013.
Arieta and Hébage are both Albanian refugees resettled to Saint-Loup, a small town close to the German and Swiss borders. Due to security reasons, they prefer not to reveal why they fled their country. Out of the city's 3,500 inhabitants, about 100 are asylum seekers. Many now come from Syria, but they also come from Kosovo, Russia, or, like Hébage and Arieta, Albania. They are usually fleeing war, starvation, or persecution. In addition to this, Hébage could not visit her father before he died 4 months ago. That is a lot to deal with psychologically, says Saint-Loup's mayor Thierry Bordeaux.
Sometimes we even encounter problems of a psychiatric nature in families who already have gone through tragedies in their lives, and when they leave their country, it can be in very challenging conditions. This psychological welcoming is still, in my opinion, something to be improved so that we can really allow them to thrive faster in our country.
And while Arieta's asylum request has just been granted, Hébage is not done yet.
I still don't have legal papers. I'm waiting, and I'm hoping it will come one day.
Her nervous laugh hides a deeper anxiety. Procedures to become legalized are becoming increasingly clogged and can take up to 2 years or more. It all begins with the OFPRA, the French Office for the Protection of Refugees and the Stateless, which is in charge of examining the legitimacy of asylum requests. Then, the French Ministry of the Interior determines how and where asylum seekers are to be resettled. In that process, Mayor Bordeaux says that, by law, he's out of the loop.
It is all dealt with internally, between the state services and private and public landlords. I guess it could be explained by a kind of mistrust of local powers, which would not deliberately want to welcome that many refugees if they had a say in it.
Not every request is granted, though, because of insufficient proof of danger to the asylum seekers in their home countries, for instance. Critics say the OFPRA even turns down valid requests, according to the French newspaper Les Echos. While other European countries grant 45% of asylum requests, France grants only 22% of them. So, what becomes of these denied refugees?
Then, families can be taken back to the border, but it is not always implemented, because on a human level, when you have to deal with families with children, it is always complicated to use the public force to expel these families. So in general, the state lets things run their course.
We are now at Saint-Loup's primary school with headmistress Anna Brace. She tells me about the online state database called CASNAV, which provides official documents translated into the refugee's language. But she admits she doesn't use it often.
I think that to integrate them, nothing's better than approaching them directly and talking to them, even if it's in broken English, even if they don't understand 100% of the conversation. I think it's better to create a human bond than give them a piece of paper, very well written in their language, sure, but which once again places a barrier. So with them, we've erased all written communication, and we try to choose them in priority for school trips. It's a way to show them their value.
Refugees take French classes 4 times a week, and their lodgings are close to the city hall and primary school, which facilitates their social integration. That way, as Arieta and Hébage are finding, other parents interact easily and keep them and other refugees in the loop.
There is everything here. A lot of solidarity. A lot of people help asylum seekers. There are also many more activities for children here. We found a lot of good things in Saint-Lô.
Their children don't find it too hard to make new friends in spite of language. But in the classroom, French remains their biggest challenge. So in Saint-Loup, an external part-time teacher comes twice a week to help refugee children study according to their needs. This proves to be efficient. After only a few months, they can integrate a normal class. For now, Hibash hopes to be legalized soon. And as for Arieta, she wishes to continue working with children, just like she did in Albania. In the meantime, the European Commission now wants to reform the current system to standardize and streamline procedures across Europe to make it easier for everyone. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
And thanks to WMRA reporters Emily Richardson-Lorente and Jordi Yeager for lending their voices to those translated remarks. When you think of an artist in residence, you might think of a painter or a potter or maybe even a poet. But what about an artist whose medium is sound? Well, that perked the ears of WMRA's Jordi Yeager, who tagged along with veteran sound storyteller Diane Ballin.
On a recent Wednesday, the sun had barely risen, and parking lots along the winding Skyline Drive were still empty, except for one car. Outside it, a woman from Portland, Maine, gently made her way down one of the most popular trails in Shenandoah National Park. She was the first one out that day, and she was on a mission.
My name is Diane Ballin. I am a sound artist, and I am the artist in residence at Shenandoah National Park. We've come down to Dark Hollow Falls to record some of the falls. And this is actually my first recording at the park.
Chances are you've heard Ballin's work. She's been making radio since back in the 1980s, when cassette recorders were cutting edge. But her pieces aren't your standard who, what, where, why reports, like this one. Rather, they're works of art, like poetic sound.
When I saw Diane's application, it was for a sound installation. I was immediately intrigued.
Lisa Wilkolak is an administrative assistant for natural and cultural resources at Shenandoah National Park.
Then I went online and listened to all of her recordings that she has available and just thought it was such a unique and different way to look at a place that people often assume is just a physical beauty and people don't necessarily pay attention to the sounds that they hear. So I was interested in hearing what she heard when she visited us.
Back in Dark Hollow Falls, Ballin puts down her giant microphone, takes off her large headphones, and stops her recorder.
What I love about sound is that we create the visuals. The sound creates a visual. With video or film, which is also, a beautiful art, the visual is created for you. I really love the challenge of creating visual with sound and how personal that is to the person who's listening, as well as the producer.
Birds, waterfalls, streams, scurrying squirrels, sure. But there's another key sound in these woods.
Hey, we're at Dark Hollow Falls. It's about 9 a.m. I just jumped in the swimming hole at the bottom of the falls and stood underneath the falls. Quite refreshing, better than a cup of coffee.
Dennis Mathewson is a physical therapist from Amherst, Massachusetts. He and his family are vacationing in the park like dozens of others Ballin talks with over the course of the morning. An IT manager and a middle school teacher from Chicago, a pair of best friends from Indiana and New York, a family from London, another from Austria, all have come to experience the wild of the park.
I love it. Nothing like nature. I mean, this is where we belong. If you sit there in the quiet is almost like a physical presence, and you just sit there and you feel part of it, you know?
Tom Knuth has come all the way from Wisconsin.
Just went out alone in the woods. Yeah. It's like it does. It becomes a physical presence. I can almost feel the silence. Reach out, grab it. I get emotional about it. It's really pretty cool.
Canoe's not alone in getting choked up. Almost everyone we meet has a visceral reaction to being in the park, and Ballin is there to capture it. Wilcolak says that in just the 1 week that she spent with Balin, it's changed how she sees, or rather, hears, the park.
My favorite part is that she gets so excited about sounds, and everything she hears, she's thinking about the possibility of using it or how it applies to something, you know. So she looks at the world in a different way. She looks at the world through sound, and it's made me spend time listening and seeing the world through sound rather than sight or smell.
Balin's pieces aren't gratuitous. She doesn't use sound just to fill space. Whether the focus is on dogs and their owners, or bird watchers, or boats creaking on docks in Iceland, Balin creates audio journeys where every sound is a guidepost, a subtle move and transition within the piece, delicately shaping and charting a broader story. Here at the park, she's not exactly sure what form the eventual piece will take quite yet, but she guesses it'll be about 10 minutes long. It'll live at the visitor center near Big Meadows for people from all over the world to come experience. For now, she's happy just basking in the sounds.
I don't worry about, you know, how it's going to work. I just am there at the moment. I think this, to me, this is the best part of recording, because you're not sitting at the bench saying, oh, you know, there's that sound in the background I don't want. It's like discovery. And you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And it's always a beautiful surprise.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. According to its website, Charlottesville's Victory Hall Opera offers a pioneering new model for an opera company, placing the creative reins in the hands of the one who knows opera best, the singer. And yowza, but can co-founder Miriam Gordon Stewart sing?
Australian-born Miriam Gordon Stewart, who has sung and still sings all over the world, is currently appearing in the Victory Hall Opera production of Der Rosenkavalier. Miriam met her wife and Victory Hall Opera co-founder Brenda Patterson while they were both attached to the Hamburg State Opera.
And we reached a point where we, having thought that the way things worked was that we would rise up the ranks within the traditional industry and get to the top, and that once we reached the top, we would have all sorts of creative control over our lives. We'd get to choose projects, we'd get to choose collaborators, we'd get to choose the roles that we did. Well, this was our own naivety, I guess, because this is not the way it really works within the traditional opera industry. That industry is, whether you are a beginner or whether you are super famous, is largely controlled by the people that run opera houses. And what we always knew, but what has really become very important to us, is that opera houses are not run by opera singers. Opera singers tend to be brought in at the very end of a creative process. Once the CEOs, the CFOs, the conductors, the directors, and everybody in between has decided what the project is that's going to be done, how many tickets it's going to sell, how they want to market it, how they want to produce it, and at the end, at the very end of that process, you are hired as a singer to just sort of fill the gap of we need a singer.
I notice you use the word opera industry.
Yeah. When I say that, I'm talking about the sort of the big houses. So, You know, the big and medium-sized houses.
It is a for-profit business.
It is a business that is dependent on selling tickets because it has become very large, very overblown. So at a certain point in opera's history, it became popular during the Romantic period of music, so the late 19th and early 20th century, to produce spectacle opera. So opera that had thousands of people and horses and cattle and angels descending from the heavens and an orchestra of 100 people and sets that, you know, were covered in real gold leaf, you know. All of this stuff became very, very popular. And it stuck a little bit in people's minds today as being representative of all opera. So opera was not always that way at all. This was a phase that has meant that all of the large opera houses in the world have gotten to become enormous in order to be able to produce that style of opera. Now, what happens when tastes change or when the market crashes or when, I don't know, people's attendance at live events change for whatever reason, technology or social media or just generational changes? Well, it doesn't leave those houses with much flexibility. So then what ends up happening...
Now, when you say big, are they just... the space is so physically big or...
Quite often they have big spaces to fill, yes. Okay. They also have big administrations and big bureaucracies and big orchestras that are full-time, big choruses that are engaged on union contracts. And the casts that they have to then hire to sing are big casts to create a big spectacle. This is wonderful. We all love spectacle every now and then, and that should definitely exist in the world. However, they do not. They just, in this world, this changing world, houses like that don't have a lot of flexibility. They perhaps don't have the flexibility to try out an unknown composer, an unknown singer, or to mess around with the art form so that they're trying something people haven't seen before. They just can't take those sorts of risks because they have to sell tickets to support this big corporate structure. That's where we come in. So we have formed a company that deliberately has a small budget and a small administration so that we can be completely flexible. We don't spend all of our time fundraising, hopefully in the future. We're not quite there yet, believe me. But in years to come, we plan to not spend all of our time fundraising because we want to produce art that is deliberately lean, and we see that as a freedom rather than a restriction. All of our focus is on the stage and what we can bring to the stage, and within that, all our focus is on the singers and advancing their craft of performing. So that's our thing. We don't want to blame the audience for diminishing numbers. We don't want to blame education of children for diminishing numbers. We actually kind of blame the product. We think that opera has fallen behind in being a relevant contemporary art form. It does not compete with the visual art world or the world of architecture in terms of experimentation, in terms of advances, in terms of reflecting modern life, and we would like to step it up a few notches.
You've said this before, haven't you?
Yeah. You're not my first interview.
No. All right. Why Charlottesville?
Well, Charlottesville's the perfect place for this because, you know, being the home of Jefferson and the home of UVA, the town's motto, I believe, at the moment is where tradition is always new. It's a town that embraces this sort of historical forms, but is incredibly open to innovation of all kinds.
Did you look at other locations?
We didn't really, because our co-founder Maggie Bell, who's from Charlottesville, and Brenda Patterson, about, was it 11 or 12 years ago, when they were fresh out of school, out of college, they got together some friends and they put on some operas in Charlottesville, just for fun, you know, just sort of, well, let's put on a show, kind of old school community theater idea.
Our folks think we're babes in arms, huh? Well, we'll show them whether we're babes in arms or not. I'm going to write a show for us and put it on right here in Seaport.
But these operas were innovative and they involved everybody in the community from the local bakery to they had bluegrass singers in the chorus, and they really made those operas, those two operas that they did, products of Charlottesville. They were surprisingly a big success. They paid for themselves. People still talk about them as being such an interesting thing that happened.
Miriam Gordon Stewart says the Charlottesville opera audience is special.
It's an audience that values art and has a real generous response to it that we haven't encountered in other places.
Generous in terms of
the energy they give back Yeah, yeah. I don't know if audiences are really aware of this, but as performers, we're so sensitive to what we're getting back from you. You might think that you're sitting in the audience and that no one knows you're there, but we know. And when you're giving back that warm-hearted energy to us, it makes our experience 1,000 times better and makes our performance better too.
You'll find pictures of Miriam Gordon Stewart and a link to the Victory Hall Opera website on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. A day is related to our rotating Earth. A year is related to our orbit around the sun. A month is related to the lunar phases. So why do we have 7 days? To answer that question, we need to associate the number 7 with something that would be observable to our ancestors. Looking out at their dark, starry night sky, they certainly saw a brilliant sky illuminated by stars and the bright fog of the Milky Way. What they also saw in their sky were objects that wandered from night to night, day to day. These wandering stars are, of course, not really stars, but the planets Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, the 5 planets you can see without a telescope. But there are 2 other objects you can also see: the moon and our sun. Add them up, and that gives you 7 objects. In fact, the names of the days of the week give the answer away. Our weekend days are named after Saturn and the sun, respectively. Monday is named after our moon. Our English names for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday are named after the Germanic gods. But in French, these days are called Mardi, Mercredi, Jeudi, and Vendredi, after the planets Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, and Venus. We have 7 days because our ancestors saw 7 objects move with respect to the stars from day to day and night to night. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Verani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Fraser, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, and click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday.